Funny thing happened to me on the way to a committee meeting. But then again, now I have more time to do things like this. And that's okay. I want to thank you both, and Elaine especially. I heard Elaine at a rally that we held in Albany last week in opposition to the Rockefeller drug laws, and she wowed them. Hundreds of people on the steps of the Capitol in rapt attention, understanding exactly what the effect of these laws are on families. And again, thank you for sharing your experience with us. My own involvement, I guess, started many years ago. I practiced law for 22 years up until 12 years ago. And during the second half of that 22-year period, did a fair amount of criminal law here in the Ithaca area. Some drug cases, not too many, usually burglaries and crimes of that nature. But we ran up against the same types of problems that have been described to you, mandatory minimum sentences. And I'll give you an idea of just one case that has stuck with me for all these years. I represented a man who was charged with a second felony. His first felony had been committed 9.5 years before, and it was auto theft. Then he was involved with using a credit card that belonged to his aunt and was charged with a felony. Under New York's statutory scheme, if you are charged with a second felony offense within a certain period of time, you face a mandatory state prison term similar to the terms that are required under the Rockefeller drug laws. We went to trial on that case. We lost in a jury verdict. They convicted him. We knew what we were up against in terms of sentencing. We went before the judge for sentencing, and the judge looked at my client and said, "If my hands weren't tied by the law, I would allow you to walk out of that door now with no further sentence. However, because of the mandatory minimum laws that we have in New York, I am required under these circumstances to sentence you to a minimum of 2 years in state prison." He went away to state prison. We appealed the case. The appeals take time. About 3 months before his scheduled release, his conviction was overturned. That was a contact that I had with mandatory minimum terms, and the fact that they handcuff the judges. What in the world do we have judges for except to exercise discretion, to do what they are supposed to do, and that is judge? If we don't allow them to judge, we might as well have a justice machine sitting up on a table, and you put your nickel in, and you pull the right lever, and the sentence comes out, and away you go. We need to infuse back into our criminal justice system that degree of discretion that Western jurisprudence has always given our judges. Now, how did these laws come about? They came about in 1973. And in 1973, we were in the midst of a dramatic upturn in drug-related crime. And the legislature in 1973 did what it does best. It panicked. They looked at the statistics. They looked at the letters from their constituents saying, "Protect us from these criminals." What do? You increase the penalties. You make it easier for prosecutors to prosecute. You impose mandatory minimum sentences so you can go back home to your constituents and say, "What a great job I did for you. We cracked down on drugs." Well, as you heard, as a result of that crackdown on drugs, we took a prison population of 12,500 in 1973 and have increased it to 71,000 today. In the 12 short years that I have been in the assembly, we've doubled the population in state prisons. It was 31,000 when I took office in 1989. And what does that mean to us generally? It means that money that might go into our schools instead go into prisons. Money that might go to social programs, to help people find jobs, to train them for work, to educate them, to rehabilitate them from their drug problems, to provide health care for everybody in this state. Money that could go into those programs instead go into bricks and mortar and bars. It means that now, like California, we spend more on our prison system each year than we do on our higher education system. It means that we have our priorities so screwed up that we can't even see the top. It is time that we reverse this, that we look at these laws, that we reform these laws, that we do what we have to do to make us again into a civilized, caring society, a society that understands that people are redeemable, that you can't throw people away by locking them away in stone buildings for the rest of their lives. So what did we do? Last year, about a year and a half ago, much to my amazement, Governor Pataki said that he was in support of reform of the Rockefeller drug laws. That was encouraging until we looked at his proposal, which was a very minimal proposal to allow some appeals of existing sentences, and he tied it to the elimination of parole. Governor Pataki is not going to reform the Rockefeller drug laws without, at the same time, get tough on crime. So he wants to repeal our parole laws while giving a limited right of appeal to some people who have been sentenced under these laws. Well, that didn't surprise me. I'm used to dealing with George. Next thing we hear is from Senator Bruno, who is the majority leader of the state Senate. Fiscal conservative, social conservative, former boxer, good-looking guy, nice teeth. He says, well, I support the reform of the Rockefeller drug laws also, because we've all heard these horror stories, like Elaine's. He never comes out with any details of the plan, just says he supports the concept. He's a concept guy. He supports the concept. Well, that didn't surprise me, because I'm used to dealing with Joe. And then we have the Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, and his spokesperson, Pat Lynch. And they come out with a statement that surprised the hell out of me. Sorry, Doug. Surprised the heck out of me. He says, through her, as most of what he says is said through her, we are not going to touch reform of the Rockefeller drug laws because our political opponents will call our members soft on crime. Well, I was overwhelmed with the courage. I couldn't believe that I read what I saw in the New York Times that day. I got on the phone and I spoke to the speaker's spokesperson. And I said, spokesperson, did you really speak these words? And she said, yes, why don't you thank me for protecting you? I called the speaker's press, not press person, but his political operative. Yep, that's our position. We're not going to do anything with the Rockefeller drug laws because you know those rotten Republicans out there will accuse you of being soft on crime, Marty, and then, my God, you may actually have to make a case to the people who you're asking to represent. And we don't want you to do that because we don't think you have the brains to do that. And then I spoke to the speaker. And I said, well, I didn't say Mr. Speaker, but I said, I am outraged. I have never been so angry in my life that you take it upon yourself to speak for me on an issue of importance to thousands of people and to belittle and diminish my ability to speak for myself and to belittle all of us who believe that this is an area that is ripe for reform. That discussion ended today. Another colleague of mine, Assemblyman Aubrey from Queens, who now chairs the I think he still chairs the Committee on Corrections, although it could change at any moment. Jeff introduced a bill last year that basically repealed the Rockefeller laws. I immediately signed on as a co-sponsor on that bill. I then began meeting with advocates in Albany, and I began meeting with experts, and this is a very complex set of laws. Began meeting with experts, began meeting with lawyers who handle these cases, began meeting with people who, family members of people who have been incarcerated under these bills, began the long process of educating myself in the details, not the generalities, of these laws. And I realized that there was a vast array of things that could be done. I also knew that Jeff's bill was dead on arrival. Given the speaker's attitude, given their political cowardice, I knew that Jeff's bill wasn't going anywhere. So I said, well, maybe I can do a different type of bill. Maybe I can do a bill that reforms the law instead of repeals it, to make it more palatable to the people who have spine problems. Call it spina miscida. And I started working on my own bill. And I consulted with a lot of experts. Now, I didn't consult with rabble-rousing leftists. I didn't consult with all of these troublemakers out there. I consulted with John Dunn. Let me tell you who John Dunn is. John Dunn is a former conservative Republican senator in New York State, state senator. He happens to have been the author of the Rockefeller drug laws in 1973 when he was in the Senate. John Dunn understands that that 27-year experiment has failed. John Dunn supports reform of those Rockefeller drug laws. And I worked with former Senator Dunn. I contacted people like Douglas Barclay, another former conservative Republican senator who was a co-sponsor in 1973, who believes that the Rockefeller drug laws should be reformed. I began working with people like Warren Anderson, a name that you may know around here. Former Senator Anderson, former Senate Majority Leader Anderson from Binghamton, conservative Republican, who feels that the Rockefeller drug laws need to be reformed. We communicated with Judith Kaye, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals of the State of New York, the highest court in the state, who feels that the Rockefeller drug laws need to be reformed. We communicated with the late Cardinal O'Connor, who felt that the Rockefeller drug laws needed to be reformed. A whole array of people from every political persuasion and complexion whatsoever, all united in an effort to reform these laws. It took me a year to draft the bill. The bill was introduced on March 22nd of this year. Between the bill that I've introduced and Jeff Aubrey's bill, and by the way, he's a co-sponsor on my bill, I'm a co-sponsor on his bill. We are not competing with each other. There is room within both of those bills to have a perfectly workable piece of legislation. Between Jeff's bill and my bill, we have 46 co-sponsors. Not duplicating names, because some people are supporting both bills. 46 individuals supporting those two bills. There are 98 Democrats in the Assembly. 46 of those Democrats want one or both or a combination of these bills to pass. That's not enough for the Speaker of the Assembly. He refuses to move either bill, and I don't think either bill will be moved this year. So when you talk about where to direct your ire, and where to direct your attention, and where to direct your efforts, the name is spelled S-I-L-V-E-R, Legislative Office Building, Albany, New York, and tell the Speaker that the time has come to reform the Rockefeller drug laws. Thank you.
I was arrested for selling 2.5 ounces of cocaine. Me and a girl who was married, she had 3 little children out on Long Island. And the judge, whose son actually died of a drug overdose, there was nothing he could do. He felt, you know, I admit it, I did it. I was selling drugs, no doubt about it. But we got a lawyer. We didn't use legal aid. We got a lawyer. We spent $20,000. And we copped out to a lesser charge. And we both got 3 to life. But the 3 years that I spent in Bedford was a complete waste. It was the biggest waste, you know? And there was a lot of people in there for the same thing. It was just the biggest waste. Anybody, the only way to beat the Rockefeller Law is to cop out. You never go to trial. No one ever stands a chance. And the judge has absolutely nothing. He cannot do anything. He's got to give you the mandatory sentence. You know, he can't, like, even, there is no circumstances. That was it, the law was the law. But those 3 years, he even said, if it was up to me, I would sentence you both to 3 years of drug rehabilitation. It's 15 years since I've been out of jail. I came out, I ended up to be very successful in business, but I never stopped using drugs. My family was torn apart over the whole thing. My mother's life revolved around making food packages and coming up to see me every single week. My whole family just fell apart. So I just wanted to share the story with everybody, just so you can see also how things go when you say, you know, some people get it one way, this color, that color, whatever the story is, I'm here to tell you. I did 3 for the same charge as Elaine did. The same charge, only mine was a sale. The same A1 felony. But I paid the lawyer, I copped out, and I wasted 3 years. I came out of that place like a pit bull. Like a freaking pit bull. So I really do hope that you're able to make some changes for rehabilitation more than anything. People need rehabilitation. Yeah. Everyone in that prison needed rehabilitation. Everyone in that place, even violent offenders, needed rehabilitation, and there was none. There was none. When I came out, it was mandated that I do, I did 3 years on probation, and then they cut me loose because I was working and I showed my pay stubs. They didn't care about rehabilitation. They made me get a stub signed if I went to an AA meeting. There was no monitoring. The minute I came out, the minute I hit the street, I was using drugs again. So I just, I'm really glad to be here and to see that people are really aware of this.
Thank you for telling us your story. Let me tell you how the bill that I have introduced would address that type of case. Under this bill, judges would have discretion, without the consent of the district attorney, to defer prosecution for up to 2 years. During that 2-year period of time, the judge could impose conditions such as rehabilitation, counseling, education, work, and so on. At the end of that 2-year period, the defendant comes back before the judge, and the judge then has before him or her a whole range of things that can be done. He can continue with the prosecution if he's not satisfied with the way the rehabilitation has proceeded. He can impose a sentence if there had been a guilty plea, can impose a sentence, can suspend a sentence, modify a sentence, can impose a probation with continuing rehabilitation and counseling provisions. It is modeled on the drug court model, which has worked very, very well around the state in misdemeanor drug cases, which is a system that we have here in Tompkins County, extraordinarily successful. This bill would take that drug court model and expand it to cover felony cases, even high-level felony cases, and give the judge that discretion. The important thing to remember is that we give the discretion to the judge, not to the district attorney, because under the current system, the DA controls the process. For the very reason that the young woman just mentioned, because the only way to beat the mandatory minimum sentences is to plea bargain, that power to accept a plea bargain is with the district attorney. My bill would remove that power from the district attorney and give it to the judge instead. And let me tell you why. We have a real life experience here. Not far from this place, up in Willard, we have a rehabilitation facility that's converted from the old Willard Psychiatric Center. When we set Willard's the rehab facility up, we had 3 funnels through which people could get to Willard. 2 of them dealt with people who are serving time in existing prisons, and we would move them out into rehab. The third was a diversion program whereby a judge, with the consent of the district attorney, could divert a criminal defendant into civil rehabilitation commitment. The problem is you needed the DA's consent.
and the DAs never consented. And those people never showed up because the DAs, again, did not want to appear. DA is an elected office, again, does not want to appear to his or her constituents as being soft on crime. So anytime you need the DA's consent, forget about it. You don't get it. That's why we give the power to the judge and not to the DA.
Yes, I just wanted to say that a lot of people don't really know what the Rockefeller drug laws are. So when they go to court and go to trial, they go to trial because they don't know. And they know that the crime that they're being charged with is not what they really did. They're guilty for delivering the package, being a mule, bringing the package up. But they're not guilty for arranging for the sale, which they're charged with. And a lot of them don't have money to get a lawyer. So when they get a public offender, he might come to see them one time, like mine did with me. He's not going to stress the fact that if you really go to trial, you're going to get 20 to life. You don't find that out till after the fact. And once it's done, appeal system, forget it. You lose all hopes and dreams dealing with the appeal system. So you stuck. Then you're lucky enough if you educate yourself and learn how to advocate for yourself and get people on the outside who don't know you, who's willing to listen to your story, take an interest in you, then you have to exploit yourself. You have to do interviews. You have to let the newspaper come and interview you. You have to get as many people as possible to get to know you because no one knows you. And that's how you get clemency. So it's 99%, you got a one-shot deal.
Thank you, Elaine, for coming. I represent some women here in Tompkins County. I work with the female inmates at the Tompkins County Jail two nights a week
for
BOCES.
Could you speak up just a little bit, please?
Oh. And, they're mothers, and a lot of them are in a very similar situation to where you were before. And they just wanted me to tell you to keep up the good work and don't give up on them.
Hey, thanks.
My name is Sarah Pines. I understand, 90% of the prison population are minorities.
Right.
And has anyone looked at the possibility, and this is a question, that this is a way of bringing about the removal and incarceration of minorities from the mainstream? The issue to me, if most of the drug dealers and druggies are Caucasian, then why are 90% of the minorities in prison?
Because most of the Caucasian high-level drug dealers are well-educated and are smart enough not to carry amounts that would trigger Rockefeller sentences.
But you have a lot of drug users all over the country, in every single community, and yet they're not doing time. But if they're Afro-American or another minority, they are.
We know that I'm also trained as a family therapist and addiction counselor, and we know in this community there are plenty of students in universities and colleges who are using hard drugs and different drugs, pills, that under the Rockefeller laws, they'd be in big trouble, but they are not being applied to that segment of the population. It's a real good question, and I think some people have done some work. Does someone in the back have, yes, ma'am. I don't know, was this in response to what was just said?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, let me go. Can you just hold for a sec while we do a response here? Thanks.
The reason that most of the people who seem to be arrested for drugs are the minority is because the law enforcement techniques are such that it's easier to arrest this population because of their method of doing business on the street, more so than the Caucasian population that do it in the backyards, on the decks, in the hot tub, you know, in the corporate boardrooms,
Wall Street, wherever
they choose to, buy and sell their wares, whereas law enforcement find it easier to buy and bust the minorities because they're mostly on the street. In fact, I don't know if you realize this, that Elaine was talking about the war on drugs being a failure, and it is. And I think because 2/3 of our war on drugs budget goes to law enforcement, the police, the correction system, and only 1/3 of the war on drugs budget goes to treatment, prevention, and education. So it's really badly skewed here.
It's just crazy because they've been talking about the war on drugs for 30 years. I can pull up Time magazines that have cover stories about it. We're going to be successful. We're going to do it. It never has worked. It's not going to work. And we know what can help people.
Let me ask.
Yeah, please.
Also, to add to that, it's because in our communities, the drugs is a survival mechanism for the people. When they go out there and get involved in drugs, they don't think that they're going to become addicted. When they go out there and sell a drug, they figure it's going to be a one-shot deal. And they get caught up. It's easy access. They don't have to go look for it. And we don't have anything else out there to offer our children. When they come out of the projects or out of the tenements, they're on the street. So it's there. They don't have to go look for it. So if I go upstairs and I don't have nothing in my refrigerator, and my mother and father can't feed me, and I can come outside and stand on this corner, and somebody older is going to put something in my hand and say, here, hold this package, I'm going to give you a couple of dollars, I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to come back the next day when I'm hungry again. I know I'm doing something wrong, but the communities is so all right till it doesn't become wrong anymore. It becomes a way of life. So even though you know that you're breaking the law and you're doing something wrong, you're surviving. And that's how so many people get caught up in it, because they have nothing else. So the money that they're spending on these prisons and everything else, invest it back in the communities. The people that you're locking up for 15, 20, 25 years, bring them out. If you got to put an ankle bracelet on them, so be it. Have them rebuild their communities. Let them do something with them kids and get them off the street. Have something else for the kids to do, and then they won't be out there getting caught up in it like that. Give them options. They don't have options. You can't make change if you feel you have nothing to change for. You got to be shown that there's a better way.
Yeah.
I just want to make one more comment on what I said before. Then I think based on everything we know, we ought to really start screaming that this is racism and that this is back to slavery and that this is lynching. And we need to use these strong terms in order to knock sense into people who have no sense. Because, well, I understand everything that you're saying, Elaine. Why do so many people in jacuzzis and on the golf course and in the universities and in Wall Street, why are they taking all these drugs? They're not getting caught. You know, there are different reasons that everybody has, but the most important reason is why are 90% of the prisoners minorities? It's a form of racism. Get them off the streets. Get them out of our sight. And I think this is what we need to bring to the attention of the public, who seem to abhor the thought of slavery. Well, it's here.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Okay. First, I want to say welcome back to the community. Back in society, and I did want to ask you, have you seen anything change after your 15 years of being away? And I also wanted to say to Marty Luster, I wanted to say that, you know, I was sitting here listening to you, and when you started to say, let's put responsibility back into the hands of the judges, that kind of scared me.
That's right.
Because
better than the legislature.
When you put it back in their hands, I mean, what difference would they do with the drug laws than what they do to us, to poor people when they come in front of them? So I'm like, can we do something different? Because that don't work.
The bill deals with that. What we do is we reduce by half the quantities needed to trigger various levels of convictions. So in order to be convicted of a high-level drug crime under my bill, you would actually have to be caught possessing twice as much as under the existing laws. So we tried to restrict that area by doing it that way. But somebody has to make a decision, and we feel that we're better off having a judge make a decision than have the legislature make a uniform decision for everyone.
Have you heard of the decisions that the judges have made lately? Oh. But my real concern is that, you know, and I heard you say a lot about with the monies and stuff that you know, going into the prisons and stuff like that. And I'm kind of with Elaine about, you know, how about let's do something with monies to keep people from having to go out and sell drugs, you know? How about building up communities so that kids don't want to go out and sell drugs? How about doing some stuff that works? You know, I've been in Ithaca for the last 7 years, and I swear y'all have more meetings than any place I've ever been in the world. You know, meetings that set up meetings to set up more meetings. And I would love to see something happen here. You know, I mean, my concern is, because I'm in recovery, and you know, and I hear a lot, and my biggest concern is about parents who get taken away, who children are taken away from them, period, in any situation, in jails, in institutions and stuff like that. And I just hope when you do start planning with the money, when these laws are changed, when you start planning with monies, you plan some programs for women where they could take their children and programs with them, because they're still separated from their children. And it's real important to know that if you look at the programs that are in existence, the majority is men, because most of us women can't take our children with us. You know, so I just want to leave you with this. Think twice on giving the judges the decision.
I just want to thank the panelists for being here this evening. And the thing that I want to say about this Rockefeller drug law stuff, I want to keep it locally, in the local arena. And this is what I want to say. We in our community here in this little small town of Ithaca, the place where dreams come true, what we need to do here is think locally and act globally. And I'm going to tell you something. I like what you're doing, Marty. I appreciate it. And Elaine, I'm so glad I met you. I'm glad you're here. And Terry. And Doug, you did a fabulous job this evening. But what I want to say is we in this community need to take the bull by the horns and stop playing games. And the game being this. The subtle racism that is perpetrated against people of color in this community. Not being allowed to have jobs. We need to get on the county legislators, the city legislators, all these folks. Because I'm going to tell you what. Here's a young man right here. I'm his mentor. He's here tonight with me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And guess what? I'm going to do everything within my power to help him make his life better. Because that's my responsibility as an African American in my community. But not only him, any other young man or woman that wants my help, my door is open. But what I'm trying to say is, and we really need to come together and do something together instead of keeping ourselves separated. So thank you, panelists. Thank you, Elaine.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Marilyn Ray. I'm really thankful for the committee bringing this all together, and for George and Edie and Catholic Charities for spearheading this whole movement. I have a sort of slightly different question, and it concerns something I've just recently found out about the census and how the Rockefeller drug laws are in fact shifting all the money out of the communities that need it most and put most people in jail and prisons. It turns out that our census laws count prisoners in the community in which they are incarcerated, not in the community in which they come from. This means that, for instance, there's a very small rural county and community about almost 275 miles northeast of here named Malone that now has three maximum security prisons in it. All those prisoners are counted in this little rural community, which is very racist, does not want any of the families of the prisoners to move there, is at least 10 hours transportation miles from the communities where their families live, which only separates the families even more, means that the families cannot keep communication, can't have visiting hours, etc., etc. And Malone not only has all the money from the prison industrial complex and all of that, but now it gets all the federal money that should have gone to the communities where the families came, live and come from, where the prisoners come from. And I want to know what we can do about that. In New York State, we have built 38 new prisons. 37 of them are in Republican districts in the far northern part of the state, further and further away from the families. Those districts are getting the money, which further impoverishes and creates the conditions that Elaine, what can we do about that?
Leave it to Marilyn for an analysis of that sort. The census is under federal law, not state law, and I think, Marilyn, I'd be happy to accompany you to visit Maurice Hinchey when he's next in town. Let's present the issue to him and see what we can do.
Good. Okay. Yeah, all right, good, good. That'll happen, too. Yes, another question, please.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the drug laws from the standpoint of someone who maybe is younger than a lot of the people who are speaking here. I remember when I was in high school in the late 1980s, they have what is known as health class. And, you know, in there they tell you various things about drugs and sex and things like that, many of which actually are demonstrably false. And, you know, this, you know, gives people the sort of idea of what you can expect from the authorities on these issues. And recently on financial aid forms for college, there is now a mandatory question that asks people if they have been convicted of a prior drug offense. About 10% of respondents refuse to answer the question, which is much larger than the fraction of those respondents which have actually been convicted of a drug offense. And now our government supports sending money to Colombia to fight drugs with, you know, planes and guns there. And now I understand that this same 10% is refusing to register for the draft. So what we really need to do, I think, in this state is send a strong signal that we don't want our country to be weakened by these lies anymore. You know, that we want to have a more sensible drug policy simply so that people will understand that the government is not out to get them.
Sonia.
Hello. I would like to make a comment. And that comment is simply, I recently became involved with this committee to repeal the Rockefeller drug law based upon a young woman who is currently in Tompkins County Correctional Facility, the county holding center, because there was a warrant out for the young man living in her house. And whatever the case, they went into her home and found 4 ounces of cocaine powder and 1 ounce of crack. She is 22 years old. She was pregnant. She did have her baby, and her baby is currently in prison with her now. But they charged her with a Class A1 felony. She has no priors. And that helped me to understand the need to educate our young people. We do realize that drugs are around, and they are very prevalent, and we do realize that the fast money is always appealing. One of the things, though, that I recognized when I spoke to a young man, I said, you know, we're having a forum about repeal the Rockefeller drug law, and, you know, if you can get up to 25 to life. And he said to me, that's if you get caught with 4 ounces or more. And so the education that they think they have really isn't good enough. Everybody that is sitting in this room really needs to understand the what it can be. You can be a small amount, and it's really not up to the judges. Those are things that should be brought out. It is up to the DA what he wants to offer. And so I'm asking everyone in this place, if you're going to really support the Rockefeller drug law, then you have to be able to educate the young people by really letting them know, first, of course, that drugs are not good, and secondly, that they chance to destroy their lives by the length of time that they'll be in prison. Another thing I wanted to address is what you said about the churches. I agree. We have turned our backs on people who have consistent problems with drug addiction. We have not opened up our arms and our hearts and said, come on in, let me work with you, let me talk with you, let me counsel you, let me share with you, let me be a support to you. And I appeal to everyone that is a pastor or minister or a regular church goer that you reach out and extend the love, because the love of God is greater than anything that we can offer them. And we need to keep that in mind. We all live because of God's love. Thank you.
I just want to comment on what she said about educating our children. Over and over again, more and more studies are showing that the DARE program is very ineffective in keeping our kids off of drugs. And that's because it's not really a reality-based education program about drugs. My fifth grader back in Albany is taking DARE, and she came home the other night, and she's fritzing out because I'm having a cup of coffee. And I said, why are you so upset? I'm having a cup of, I always have coffee. She says, well, coffee's a drug. And I said, where'd you learn that? She said, well, DARE, they're comparing, you know, coffee to cigarettes to heroin to beer, you know, and comparing apples and oranges and coming up with grapes. And it's a good thing I'm on top of this issue and I can re-educate her at home, but I'm thinking, how many children are leaving our schools and not having somebody at home to talk to about this? And for that reason, FAM has put together a special program which we can send you a copy of if you want to sign up for it. And it not only is more reality-based drug education, but there's also a big portion of it about sentencing and the law, because most of our kids, most of us, don't know anything about mandatory sentencing until it hits our family. Everybody I've ever talked to had no clue what these mandatory minimums were until they got caught up in some situation. So our coordinator, who's a school teacher in Massachusetts, put together a wonderful program. And if you would like a copy of it, we can send that to you, and you can take it to your school board, your school district, wherever you're from, and ask if this, in addition to DARE, because I'm sure DARE is going to be around for a while. I don't know if they use DARE in Ithaca or not, but they certainly do up in Albany. But you can put this program side by side with DARE and at least give them the legalities of what could happen with drugs to the
good
kids.
Thank you.
I had a question, I guess, Marty. What would it take to get another program like CETA? Remember, there was a CETA program years ago. And what would it take to get something like that back in our communities where people can go somewhere and know that they can get a job if they fit a certain criteria? I was just wondering if there's anything coming in effect.
Well, again, that's one of those political battles that seems to never end. Last year, I introduced, along with a number of my colleagues, a $50 million jobs program bill modeled after the old CETA program. That bill still sits in a file somewhere in Albany. Costs too much bureaucracy, too much government involvement in our lives. It's old-fashioned, it doesn't work anymore, every excuse you can think of. The political climate for that type of program simply is not right at this time. And that's a lousy answer, and you shouldn't accept it, but it's the honest answer. What's happened, because times are relatively good in a fair number of localities in New York, and notice how careful I am about not generalizing. The pressure is off the legislature to enact that type of comprehensive program. When times are bad, then the pressure comes back on. But of course, when times are bad, tax revenues are down, and it's that much harder to do it. The time to do it is now, when tax revenues are up and we have surpluses and we can spend it or invest it in programs of that sort. It's a very hard political pitch to make, and the way to do it is to get people into politics and involved and speaking out. And in good times, that's hard to do. People are satisfied to go home and put the tube on and know that there's a paycheck coming next week. We need to keep people involved in this system, good times and bad, and then maybe we can make some advances.
What a radical idea. We have some extra money, good times, let's put it aside to build good programs and help people, not wait until there's no money in a recession.
Is that bill, are you going to bring that bill up again or something like it?
The bill gets buried each year as part of the budget discussions. That's the process whereby most rank and file members have very little input and direct say in what's happening. It's handled by the three leaders, the governor, the speaker, the majority leader of the Senate. Big items like that are handled by the three leaders. And you know, I hate to sound like a broken record, but until the leadership is changed in all three places in Albany, I don't see much hope of changing the our ability to get that type of thing done.
Hi, my name is Phil Zack. I live up in Spencer. First, I'd like to, I guess, apologize. Something was done in my name, I guess, to you. I'd like to apologize for that. I didn't ask for that to be done, and I think it's wrong. Now, I'd like to ask a question, please. I'm an engineer, and I like to see data. Is there data to support an alternative method other than just, you know, tossing people away and locking them up?
Yeah. There's a study that was done by the RAND Foundation, a very comprehensive study that indicates that rehabilitation is something like 15 times as effective as incarceration in terms of turning people around, making them productive, and to use the vernacular, to get them into well-paying jobs that have a future. There is a ton of data to support that. That RAND study is probably the most recent and the most comprehensive study. There are smaller studies that handled various aspects. The racial aspect that's been brought up, it's clearly demonstrated that mandatory minimum sentences in drug cases is clearly racist in its application. There are studies nationwide that prove that. And there are smaller academic studies throughout the nation. But I can give you the reference to that RAND study.
Well, as long as, you know, we've got that backed up, you know, little substance. And just one comment I'd like to make, I think that a lot of the people I know who've had a lot of problems with drugs have been in a lot of pain, and I don't see what causing them more pain is going to do.
Right,
you
exactly.
know, you got to look at the root cause.
Right.
Thank you.
My name's Tim Joseph. I'm a member of the County Board of Representatives, and about a year ago, our county started looking at building a bigger jail, expanding our jail capacity, because our jail is filled up with people charged with drug offenses. And at the time, I said, no, we're not going to do this. There's better things to do. We can look at rehabilitation. We can look at drug treatment. We can look at why people are committing crimes in the first place. We can look at programs to support families, since one of the things we know about people in jail is that most of them were abused kids. All of them are poor. If we could deal with child abuse and poverty, we wouldn't have anybody left in jail. And I started to say things like that, and I got pretty strongly identified with that position publicly. And a funny thing happened to me. People started stopping me on the streets, in the grocery store, everywhere I went. Some of you might think that's normal for people in elected office, but it's not. It's actually kind of amazing how seldom I hear unsolicited from anybody about anything. But suddenly, I'm being stopped all over the place about this. And what people are saying universally is, don't let them build that jail. Good going. I'm really glad you're doing that. Don't give up the fight. And these are not my friends. These are not all the local activists I know. These are people who tell me I'm conservative. I usually agree with you. But this time, you're on the right track, and I hope you stay there and don't let them do that. And I've been pretty puzzled about what's going on here. Why this issue? Why all the conservatives? Why are all the conservatives jumping to my defense around not building a jail? And I start engaging them in conversation, and they start talking about how absurd it is, how stupid it is, how wasteful it is to be locking so many people up, especially for drugs. And this, I mean, there's two things going on. For some of them, it's money. They look at a jail expansion and they say, there's the county wanting to blow another $20 million. Not with my tax money, you don't. But then there's another side, this part about how foolish it is to keep spending money that way and how there's so much better ways. And I don't expect to hear that from the people I'm hearing it from. And it finally sunk into me that they know someone. They know someone who's been hit by these laws.
We all do.
That these laws have become so pervasive and so oppressive that people you wouldn't expect it from are turning against them, because when it was get tough on crime and get tough on drugs, because those people need to be in prison, that was one thing. When it was my daughter's best friend and the pitcher on the high school baseball team, or somebody else that they know, or that the friend of theirs knows, suddenly things take a different turn, and they realize that this is not one of those criminal drug dealers who is responsible for drive-by shootings and all that. This is the kid in my high school with one of my kids. Maybe it is one of their kids. And maybe it didn't go so far as they actually went to prison. Maybe they were able to cop a plea because they were white and rich, and they got a plea to something less that didn't involve one of the mandatory minimums, but it scared them. It came close enough that they realized how narrow an escape they'd had.
And I think any parent in this county, who's got, I have four teenagers, grew up in the 60s. We know that our kids could be in that situation. We all know kids who are using drugs, and we know, all of us know people who are alcoholics and have addiction problems. And these laws are just doing the exact opposite of what needs to be done. And prisons, too. I mean, what a waste to put people with a problem like addiction in prisons. Yeah, don't build that jail. And I don't want to speak for all the conservatives, but, But I'll speak for my Republican friends. You know, 2 years ago in Arizona, they revamped the whole thing. Arizona, I don't think of it as a big liberal state. You know, I mean, Barry Goldwater was there, John McCain. They did a whole thing. They renewed, they changed all their laws, and now instead of prison for nonviolent first offenders, probably even for more than first offenders, they're given mandatory drug treatment.
They prohibit jail sentences.
Arizona.
Yeah.
And I think,
wait till we fall in Mississippi. They were really good.
I think the message for politicians is that the days of being tough on crime and getting elected for that and being afraid of being labeled soft on crime are ending.
Yeah. But we want to be smart on crime, and not stupid on crime.
Is going to be the new thing that's going to get you elected. Right. And I think maybe you can point out to them what they did in Arizona. And ask how many people lost the next election because they were soft on crime.
A lot of us don't see these issues with addiction and drugs as crime at all, actually. I don't want to go on more on saying that, but it's just such a great... Thank you, Tim.
Hi. I have a question. For a person who just comes out of prison, they've been charged with a felony and convicted of that felony. For example, as yourself, Elaine, you have a family of four. I know to receive any type of public housing or any assistance, if you have a felony, you're not going to be able to receive those type of help. What happens to reintegrating you back with your family in the community? And if you need an apartment or a place to stay or some assistance, but you're unable to apply for it because you've been convicted of a felony, how is that going to help the family composition and staying together and keeping you in the community?
Basically, when you come out, you're on your own. You're just thrown back out into the community. You can go into a project apartment, but if the conditions, like for myself, when I came home, I felt like I came home to another prison. It's sad to say, but the conditions and the fact that they're in a three-bedroom apartment and the way in which they're living. When I went to housing to try to talk to them to see if we can get a bigger apartment or separate me and my kids and let my sister and her kids have that apartment, she told me in a nice way, you have a felony conviction. You're not supposed to be here in the first place. We know the conditions of the house because they had to take us to court to have it painted. Basically, be thankful and be quiet. So, with a felony conviction, something that I was accused of doing 16 years ago, 16 years later, I cannot live in the project. I can't have my name on a lease. To apply for Section 8, they're telling me I can't have that either. But they're going to have to give me a hearing on it because I'm going to fight them all the way.
Good. We do need to... we said we'd try to get this over about 9, and we know it. Number of people have other places like to be. If there's anyone who has a short, quick question, a quick, short question?
Yeah. Now, one thing that I just want to point out here is that this is also a narco game that goes on with the narcotics cops, and it's like a pigeon kind of thing. And this girl was set up, okay? Yeah. This arrest even happened in the first place because the police pushed it. Okay? And that's how they get each next bus. They get one guy to turn in someone else, and they specifically want a specific amount. They didn't want 3 ounces. They wanted 4 because they wanted that A1 felony. It's like speeding tickets, you know? This is how narcos work. A lot of this stuff that goes on was more fueled by a narcotics agent pushing somebody else who got caught into catching somebody else.
The panel discussion on the Rockefeller drug laws you just heard originally took place in Ithaca last May and was sponsored by Catholic Charities.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.